Welcome to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Stock market, wealth, personal finance, value stocks. Invest in your life.
Hello, Smart Money Tree Podcast listeners. Welcome to this week's show. My name is Kirk Chisholm, and I will be your host. I am once again joined with my good friend, Doug Hagren. Hey, Doug.
Thanks for having me again, Kirk.
So let's kind of dive right in. So, Doug, we're starting the new year, right? And we wanted to do a quick summary of last year and then come to find out it's only 6 days in and most people haven't gotten their numbers in. So we're probably going to push our year-end summary that I love to do until next week. It's going to be a little bit different. We do it on our Friday episode as well, but we wanted to do one on this episode and really dive right in. We're going to push that until next week when we go live. But this week, we want to talk about some other kind of year-end topics, which are also very important. So where do you want to start with this, Doug?
2022 left a lot to be desired for people in a number of different areas. We talked about in the past couple of conversations, the impact of housing, the impact of interest rates, inflation, markets. People are looking at their performance statements, wondering what in the heck happened to them. They just got run over by a truck, you know, and how relative that is compared to what has happened in the markets in the past. Any one of these things are certainly on the back of the minds of individuals who be listening to the show or basically have money. Want to know what's the next move to make in this world and how's 2023 going to look. Obviously, we're going to cover a lot more of that with a year-end wrap-up, but as we continue kind of in out of the Christmas holiday into the new year, we do have some information we can look at. It's just in terms of what 2022 ended up as. Let's talk a little bit about just kind of performance and kind of what things looked at as we ended up heading down the ramp of 2022.
Let's look at that here. So right now, for those of you who are watching this live on LinkedIn or live on YouTube, you'll be able to see this. Those of you who are listening at home, we'll try to verbalize it. Otherwise, you can look at it in the show notes. But right now, we're looking at I think this is one day off, but it's approximately correct because the year end was about even. This is a one-year chart of every stock in the S&P 500. And it's based on size. So the bigger squares are the larger companies, obviously Apple, Microsoft, Google, Amazon, Johnson & Johnson, ExxonMobil are some of the larger ones. And then you got some really tiny ones you can't really see. I like this visual because it kind of shows you how the market did last year. And it shows you based on size, and it also shows you based on sector. It's a great visual. A lot of people just throw out numbers. These have numbers, but I think just the visualization is really important. So you can see, what did well last year? Well, healthcare did well. That was a great sector. And energy. Both of those were up, even though the S&P was down, I think, 19.4 approximately percent last year. NASDAQ was close to 30. Bonds are down around 20 plus. So it was a really ugly year. And you look at tech, everyone's favorite darling, tech, you know, oddly enough, if you look at the big companies, the technology is two companies, and you got Google and the communication services, and then you got Amazon and Tesla and consumer cyclical. So tech is really spread out. But the larger companies are down 30 to 50%, some case 71% in the case of Tesla. So you had some really ugly stock performances last year. But I think looking at the whole picture, it shows you where you could have been that would have done okay. What are your thoughts on this, Doug, as you look at this?
Healthcare, energy stand out. Aerospace and defense certainly stands out as a place that did really well. Insurance, interestingly enough. You know, it's funny when things get a little bit more uncertain, how protection ends up being something that people care a little bit more about than when the times are really good. And I like to say this to individuals I'm talking about is it's funny how that becomes a concern when there's times of uncertainty, but really need to think about protecting yourself, whether it's from insurance or it's like through your portfolios or anything else you need to do. You need to prepare for the certainty of uncertainty when the times are good. And unfortunately, it just kind of goes against human nature to do that. I think a good analogy is, why do we have a seatbelt in our car? We have a seatbelt in our car, not because it is an incredible fashion statement. I mean, I don't know about you. I mean, they still haven't designed seatbelts to look as fancy as a nice big belt buckle and, you know, hold up your pants. They're pretty ugly. They do
Do you remember taking your driver's ed test? Two of the answers for what a seatbelt's used for, one is to keep you warm, and the other one was to keep your groceries from falling over. Those were two of the answers on the test. I still remember it to this day.
Oh, they were not on my quiz in Ohio, where I grew up. Massachusetts has, is that where you grew up, Kirk?
Massachusetts, yes.
That's an interesting question. So there you are. And they are. I will say it is an excellent excellent tool for keeping your groceries from flying around. It's also nice because if you have one of those sensors in your car now that ultimately does tend to go off and beep and tell you need to put your seatbelt on when you're sitting in it. When you put those heavy groceries on the passenger seat, it starts to beep and tell you you need to put the seatbelt on. So it's reminding you to secure those groceries so they don't move around in the car. But the key is the real reason that we have a seatbelt is not to be a fashion statement, and it's not to put on when you're going through the windshield. And unfortunately, that's the thing that most people tend to do. And we talked about this, Kirk. We tend to confuse the difference between volatility and risk. Volatility is market going up, market going down. When people say, well, the stock market's very volatile, well, that actually can be a good thing, because if it goes up 50%, that's a volatile market, right? If it goes down 50%, it's also a volatile market. Risk is, as you have stated, Kirk, many times, it is the potential for permanent loss of capital. And I don't know about you, but I have never been in a major car accident in my entire life. And hold on, knock on a little bit of wood here, that never occurs. But yet I still wear my seatbelt every time I get in the car. It's not because, and I don't feel risk. When I get in the car and I drive, I'm a pretty confident driver. I don't feel risk, but the risk is always there, just like it is in the markets, just as like it is in health. It's always there. So the reason we wear our seatbelt is that the risk is there and we want to be protected once that risk gets realized. We don't throw our seatbelt on at the time that we feel the risk. Otherwise, we'd be trying to grab it as we're halfway through the windshield. And so last year was a year that a lot of risk finally came to play. Now, time will tell if this was volatility or if we're seeing the beginning of true risk, permanent loss of capital. We'll find out. I think those listening to the show believe that we feel strongly that we're going through a paradigm shift and that is going to result in some long-term hurting. It's not surprising, although that's a segue there, to see that insurance did very well last year because once again, people started to feel that there may be some certainty of uncertainty. The other thing I wanted to note is that consumer defensive really wasn't. I mean, you have a couple things in there. I mean, Warren Buffett did great last year, relatively, right? Berkshire B's up. He owns a lot of Coca-Cola. That was up. Pepsi. Costco, surprisingly, way down. And you would think that, of course, in an area where food prices were going up, that that would actually be a boon for warehouse shopping. But consumer defensive really didn't defend very well. The other thing that I wanted to note out here is that there is a massive misunderstanding that most people have in terms of what they hold and what diversification is. Because a lot of people, you know this, Kirk, you say, well, if I'm holding the S&P 500, I'm diversified. I'm holding 500 stocks and it's allowing me to have broad exposure to the market. When you look at this picture and you look at the size of some of the holdings in here, would you say that this looks like you have a broad spectrum diversification going on?
I don't think so.
Without doing any simple math here, I can see that technology is taking up 20% of the picture and communication services is probably taking up maybe 10% of the picture. Consumer cyclical is also taking up maybe 5%. And again, I'm making this up just randomly looking at it, but notice some names here: Google, Meta, Amazon, Tesla, Apple, Microsoft. I mean, you could put a different label on them, but most people would agree that these are predominantly technology-based companies. And it's roughly looking like about 30% of the holdings. So how many people out there truly believe that I could just buy the S&P 500 company, buy the S&P 500 index fund, and then I'm going to buy some QQQ because I want to have exposure to the NASDAQ, and that's diversification. And it's not. It is a highly concentrated portfolio that has done very well in low interest rate, low inflation environments, which tend to do very well for probably Microsoft excluded here. If you look at Apple, which of course, cell phones, that's been big and people love to buy their technology and a lot of people put them on credit card and a lot of people buy light lease or payment plans. Google, Meta, Amazon, Tesla, all of these things do very, very well. And then we get into semiconductors. So add that to technology, right? And information tech is its own category and software. I mean, when it comes down to the breakdown of it, most people weren't very diversified. And that looked really, really good when the markets were benefiting from low interest rate, low inflation environments. But what are you feeling now? 30%, 40%, 50%, 31% declines. And is that going to continue? Well, unless we get out of inflation and get out of high interest rates, I think there could definitely continue to be some bleeding that people are going to feel. And ultimately, it also hopefully is a sign that people need to understand and be educated on what diversification really means. And just holding, even if it's an index fund, you need to understand what's under the hood before you start driving it. So that to me stands out.
One quick follow-up here, because you made some great points there. And you mentioned using like the Qs as a way to diversify. I just want to point this out because I don't think a lot of people know this. The NASDAQ is largely a technology index. I think people know that. But what they don't know is that 0% of that index is in basic materials, 0% is in real estate, 0% is in energy. Now, we have less than 1% in utilities. We have less than 1% in financial services. And I would argue probably those financial services are fintech or fintech related, and they're probably not even financial. Now, think about it. You've got most of that index, 50% in technology, 15% in communication services, which is pretty much Google, and 14% consumer cyclical, which is pretty much Amazon. It's pretty much all tech. Now, when you look at what does well and what doesn't do well, what does well when growth is doing well is pretty much technology. That does great. What are the sectors that tend to do well when we're in a recession or in a bear market? Well, basic materials, industrials, healthcare, energy, financial services. You could argue that in the consumer sector, consumer defensive, but generally speaking, that should also do well. Although I would argue right now they're all kind of expensive. But the point is you have these things that are typically beneficial in certain times, and there are things that are typically not beneficial. And I think we've seen last year, there was a lot of sector rotation. Is everyone owned tech? Everyone owned FANG stocks? Because why not? They went up 50% a year. Why wouldn't you own them? Well, I mean, that's silly thinking. That's like in the late 90s when people said, well, I made 100% on my tech stocks last year. What can you do for me? Can you make me 200%? It's kind of ridiculous when you think about it, but I literally had those conversations with people where people were complaining like, oh, can you get me 100%? If you can't, I'm not interested. It's just silly talk. And I think that's what we saw a lot of in the last few years. And now that's resetting. You're seeing this with some of these numbers in tech where people are rotating out of tech because they're seeing higher interest rates means tech's going to struggle a little bit. Now, are they going to continue to grow? Sure. But do they deserve the valuation they had in 2021? Absolutely not. And we're seeing that. And the valuations are going to end up being much lower, not because they're not growing, not because they're not good companies, but because the valuations are overextended. And when interest rates go up, it causes valuations to drop. There's a lot of reasons for that, but let me just give you a simple reason. Now, in the last few years, people were looking for income and bonds were yielding zero or close to zero. So where could you get yield? Stocks, dividend stocks, right? You can get 1-2%. That was pretty much all you could get for income. Now I can get 4-4.25%, in some cases higher for income on bonds. So why do I want to own stocks? Well, I don't need to own stocks. Or if I do, the dividend yield needs to be much higher in order for me to buy those stocks. So if I owned a utility stock and it was paying me 2%, and that was a really good rate, when the average, I don't know what it was last year, but the S&P I think was under 2%. But if you were getting 2% compared to everything else, that might've been great. But now if I can get 4% on a guaranteed government bond, well, that utility is not so attractive at 2. Maybe it's more attractive at 5 or 6. And so that's a lot of what's going on is the repricing of assets compared to what a lot of people call the risk-free rate. You can make the argument if it's risk-free, but people refer to it as the risk-free rate. And that's your comparison. So if you're taking no risk, you can get this rate at the risk-free rate. Anything else should be higher or else you're going to take more risk. And why would you take more risk and get less return? So that's one of the reasons that the rotation is going on and will continue to go on through this year until asset prices have come to a more reasonable valuation. Now, you know, what I think is going to start to happen, and I want to share some other assets here before we kind of go on to some of the other charts. But this is maybe hard to see, but this is year-to-date relative performance with assets, which includes commodities. So the indexes are in there, but it also includes commodities. So the top performers here, orange juice with close to 46%, about heating oil of about 41%, rough rice at 23%, and then it goes there on. And at the bottom, lumber is the worst performer from negative 66%, oats negative 46%, and the NASDAQ at negative 32%. Now, I point this out because there's obviously a lot of discrepancy in between. Some things did well, like the softs, the ags, the soybeans, the corns. Then you had some platinum was in there, and then you had some fuel, gas, and crude. And on the downside, you had a lot of currencies, which, you know, is a different chart, but there's a lot of currencies. The US dollar was up 8%. Everything else is pretty much down in comparison. And then you have the indexes, and then you've got some of the metals like copper, and you got some softs, cotton and coffee. It's all over the map. We point this out because last year, no matter what you were in, was down, unless you were in energy or other certain commodities, because some commodities did okay. So there's a framework that I don't think most people realize is when I started, people used to talk about stocks, bonds, and commodities. Now, in the last 15 years, I haven't heard anybody talking about commodities. People don't say that anymore. People forgot about commodities. Why? Because the performance stinks. For the last 15 plus years, the performance has been horrendous. They've lost money or not made money in general for the last 15 years. And when you can make 10, 20, 50% on stocks, why would you bother even looking at commodities? And bonds, well, you need to own bonds because they're safe. So that is the framework that people were using. And we're letting the listeners know because this is going to start to come back into trend. It started last year and it's going to continue where commodities are going to be more important because there's more demand for it and probably less production of it given what's going on in the world. Not only that, but also the price of everything is going up, which means commodity prices are going up. There's a lot of buoyancy to commodities and no one's paying attention to them. Very few people. Even last year, I think the allocation to commodities was 2% across the board, if that. It was definitely less than 5%, where maybe it should be 20%. I don't know what the right allocation is, but the point is it shouldn't be 2%. 2% is way too low. I mean, we're looking at gold and our gold allocation is bigger than that. And that's just one commodity. So I would say the way you should look at it is this is all relative in comparison. And you probably remember, I know you remember, Doug, the conversations we had about lumber with the bullwhip effect and how lumber went from 230 up to 700, back to 240, up to 1400. So obviously this is on the downside of that. It doesn't mean that, you know, lumber is a bad asset. It just means that, you know, it's on the other side of the trend and you just need to be aware of it. So any final thoughts, Doug, before we kind of jump into some other inflationary charts, which people want to hear?
The last thing I'll just say about it is this is another example. And I know how you feel, and we've talked about kind of diversification. What does diversification mean? Is diversification working right now? And I think we've certainly debunked under the current economic pressures and interest rate pressures that a 60-40 portfolio diversification, which is, again, not that diversified, right? The 40% goes to aggregate bonds, which don't really include a lot of bonds in there, and bonds that may have done better, or fixed income that may have done better in recent interest rate environment. And the 60 doesn't really include anything more than like the S&P 500, which we just showed here, isn't all that diversified, especially against normal portfolios. I think at one point, you know, not to tick up a whole generation, but I think they published that the typical top 10 holdings of Gen Y, it was Gen Y or Gen Z, was basically 9 out of the 10 were technology stocks and the 10th was Berkshire B. And so again, that's not very diversified at all. But I think what you just said about commodities and how little people were holding of commodities, 2%. And why were they holding 2%? They're holding 2% because of the poor performance. Well, right there should make you pause as investors and say, I'm doing this wrong. Because why did you only have 2%? You only had 2% because it was performing poorly. Well, that is the opposite of how you should think about investing. Thinking about investing is you should be buying more of what's performing poorly under the right conditions and really increasing your allocation and buying up cheap property so that when it recovers, you're able to benefit from that. But what people do is the opposite. When it's starting to go down, when it's not performing as well, that's when they want to sell it off and they want to go buy expensive things. And again, it's another example of how that repeats itself over and over again and why that leads to a systematic failure in long-term performance. But it also goes to something I've said before. You are only diversified if there's something that you don't like in your portfolio. If you don't hate something in your portfolio, you are not diversified. That's simple. But what people will tend to do is they will tend to remove what they don't like when it's not performing and load up on things that are expensive, and it'll come back to bite them. So if you were diversified, you would have not been happy with having commodities for all those years. Guess what? You'd be happy now.
People talk about how they can't see the future and, you know, how diversification is the answer to that. And yet people weren't diversified. They didn't include it. It's fine for the last 15 years, but if you're going to wait another 15 years to realize the writing's on the wall and commodities will be more expensive, then you'll just be missing out on easy layups. You know, I don't want people to get angry and say, you told me to do commodities and commodities are down this year. You know, we talk about this in the show. I very much think we're going into recession, which is going to impact everything. So I'm not saying you go out and put all your money in commodities. What I'm saying is that commodities are an important part of the portfolio and you need to do it thoughtfully. Now, investing in just commodities in themselves can be a bit of a challenge for most people because I don't know what the daily fluctuations of the coffee market or orange juice or, as Fletch says, ball bearings. Everything's ball bearings nowadays. If you look at these different markets, you don't have to be an expert in each one. But there are some strategies out there that will invest in commodities in a trend following approach. If I were to put money in commodities outside of very specific ones that I follow closely, I would find a trend following approach because commodities do really well with trend following. They trend extremely well. And a lot of the largest money managers use trend following approaches with commodities because the markets are big enough. Of course, they also use currencies and other things, and we won't get into the weeds, but a lot of people do them. There's a lot of trend following managers out there when it comes to commodities. So just do your own homework. There's even a few public ETFs, one of which I really like in the way that they've constructed it. But in general, just do your own homework and come up with a way to add commodities to your portfolio and do it in a thoughtful way. I would put gold in a different category because gold's more like a currency than it is a commodity. It's a little bit of both. Silver, I know my gold bug friends will disagree with me here. Silver, it can be one of each. It can be a currency and it can be an industrial commodity. I think it's more of an industrial commodity. It acts more like an industrial commodity, or sometimes it's gold on steroids, but you never know which one it is because sometimes it just doesn't act well. And we've seen that in the last few years. Hey, Doug, did you hear? We're giving away free money. Well, I'll tell you about it in a bit. There's a saying in the mining community. Well, precious metals mining, that is. The saying is that if you want the best deals, you have to be in the room. Now, you're probably thinking, what does it mean to be in the room? Well, I'll tell you. Being in the room means that you're on the short list of people who get invited to be a part of the best deals. These are the deals that most investors will never have access to. You mean like IPOs? Nope. IPOs are chump change. Those are for retail investors, small potatoes. That's nothing compared to these deals. These deals would have you salivating to get access to them. Once you know they exist, you will never look at investing the same way again. I almost don't want to tell you they exist because it'll ruin your thinking of how the investing world really works. Now, you might be excited that these deals exist, but you only have access to the deals if you're an insider or in the room, as they call it. As loyal listeners of the show, I'm going to give you a chance to be in the room. Money Tree Investing Podcast has created the Insiders Club. This is a community of our show's members who are loyal listeners of the show and want to get more out of their investing experience. Being a part of the Insiders Club gives you insider status for upcoming events and private webinars, discounts, free stuff and books, and influence on the future direction of the show. This is an opportunity to join us as we expand our content and services. Oh, did I mention you're getting free money? Yes, in the next few weeks, I will be giving free money to members of the Insiders Club as my appreciation for listening to the show. There's no cost to join the Insiders Club. Just go to moneytreepodcast.com/free money. Do that today to join the community. That's moneytreepodcast.com/free money. I hope to see you in the room. Let's get into some other commodities because I wanted to point this out. This is really, to me, fascinating. So here is egg prices. Now, you wouldn't think of this. Now, anybody who does shopping, and I don't do the shopping in my house, even though I do all the eating of eggs, I don't do the shopping for them. I was talking to a friend of mine, and they're like, did you know like eggs in certain parts of the country are like $11 a dozen? I remember a few years ago, it was like $2.30. Now they're $11. Eggs have gone through the roof in terms of prices in large part because of the bird flu. Here's an article from the Wall Street Journal that kind of shows wholesale price of eggs up to 500 cents per dozen, which I think this is actually a little bit old because I think they're a little bit higher. But the point is just look at the chart. They're normally just under 300 at the high, and now we're at 500. The point here is not to go invest in eggs. I will tell you that last summer we did Rent a Chicken. I don't want to advertise these guys for free, but I will because of a good experience called rentachicken.com. They will build a coop. They will give you a bunch of chickens. They'll give you enough feed for like 6 months, and they just pop them in your backyard and they're like, good luck. And it was a great experience for the kids. We went around, they got to learn about chickens, learn about keeping them healthy and happy and all that. And they're funny creatures. But the point was, is, you know, I was thinking, well, hey, we got a benefit here because they lay eggs and we don't have to go pay for eggs for a bunch of months. And they didn't always produce, especially on the hot days, but we got a lot of free eggs. It was great. And I wish I had the chickens right now. We gave them back because I didn't want to do it in winter, but it's a great tool for being resilient. And it's not for everybody, especially for those who live in the city. But I do want to point it out because this is just one indication, just like lumber was, this is egg prices and it's right now. Now, here's another one. But at the opposite end of the spectrum, DRAM prices. This is computer memory. So you have basically prices for DRAM chips have started the early of 19 at like 6.7. Right now it's around 2. So we had a little bump and a little peak in mid-July, and then now it's July of 21, and now it's down to 2, which is really low. And you could make the argument why that is, but I'm pointing it out because just because there's inflation, it doesn't mean that everything is high. So you need to be mindful. Inflation is a general sentiment. It is a general tool to measure inflation in the economy. So the CPI is the measure that's used. Now, we talked about this during COVID. There were a lot of things that were inflationary. A lot of things were deflationary. What was inflationary? Well, you could argue Peloton or cycling at home, food at home, books, internet services, and then you could argue it was deflationary, hotels, airfare, work clothes. You can have inflation and deflation at the same time. Now, this is an example. We obviously have, you have deflation here in terms of prices. And on the other hand, you have eggs, which are inflationary. So both of those can exist at the same time, and they do. It is the aggregate of all of them that matter, and that's what matters to the economy. I want to hit on one more really quick, and then I'll let you kind of have your two cents here, Doug. This is what we call shrinkflation. This is basically showing candy bars from 2014 to 2018. Shows enormous amount of inflation over that four-year period, you know, anywhere between 16% and 28%. I'm sorry, that's not the price. That is the amount that they gave you was deflationary, which in effect is also inflationary another way. You're getting less for the same price. So this is what was happening across the board for goods at the grocery store, especially. They would just give you bigger bags and less stuff, or they would charge you more for less. And this is still going on. It's a secretive way for them to have inflation on goods that they're trying to hide. This has been going on for a long period of time. And I will tell you that if there's one thing you can invest in that is inflation proof, it is candy, especially chocolate. Look at Hershey's. They've been inflation proof since they've been around. And chocolate and candy and companies that produce it do have a very heavy inflation hedge. Go ahead, Doug.
And that makes sense because, of course, when if things are going up and people are feeling more stressed, what do? They tend to fall back to their vices. If you want a good read, it's a little outdated now, but the book Good to Great talked about the difference between R.J. Reynolds and Philip Morris. And one of the big differences between R.J. Reynolds and Philip Morris is what they invested in. R.J. Reynolds was buying health products and selling cigarettes. It's like, where's the continuity there? Philip Morris was much more strategic and brilliant in there. I mean, going back to the chart, I saw that Toblerone was listed there. Philip Morris, I don't know, you know, now Altria, I don't know if they still own it. I haven't looked in a while, but they went and they invested in buying Toblerone. They went out there and they invested in buying, let's see, I'm trying to think what other sodas and candies and of course cigarettes. They're like, look, what's our business model? Sin foods. I mean, we're here. If you're stressed out, if you want to feel better, you know, grab a bite of something that you probably shouldn't have, but you know that you can't stop yourself from having anyway. You know, addiction foods. That's what they did. And you know what? They have always done, typically have done very, very well. Now, I'm not telling you to run out and invest in them because a regulatory environment has changed a lot for these companies. But the point being is that they always did back when they were still running things normally very, very well in those types of environments because people will tend to turn to their vices to get through stressful periods. So I think you make a good point there, Kirk. The other thing I wanted to point out is shrinkflation. One of the first shrinkflation examples I ever saw. And what was funny about it is now we're getting shrinkflation without advertising because people become more aware of it. And, you know, they might pull a couple ounces away and keep the price the same just to kind of help make you feel, hey, I'm buying something similar. But one of the worst examples and first examples I ever saw, Kirk, I think I told you about this one time, was Milky Way Light candy bars. I think it was the Milky Way Light. It was 33% less fat. Look at the ingredients. Certainly did not have any ingredients. You know, a lot of times, I think you talked about snack wells in a previous conversation, you know, love those snack wells. They would say, well, we're going to make you this baked good with different ingredients, and that's going to make it better for you. Milky Way didn't change a thing. I'm looking at this going, all right, the ingredients are the same. But what did I notice? 33% smaller than their original Milky Way candy bar for the exact same price. And what's sad is, Kirk, is the number of people that bought into this marketing strategy, because I just Googled trying to remember what it was. And sure enough, this is from 2001. Somebody posted on a healthboards.com, Milky Way Light candy bars, weight loss message board, Milky Way Light candy bars. Yum. I just wanted to let everybody know about my latest discovery. They're only 170 calories and 5 grams fat, and they fit nicely into my eating plan. So people celebrated getting a 33% smaller candy bar for the same price because they felt that this was healthier for them. So it just goes to show you, you can market anything to anyone and there will be someone to buy it. Just be smarter than that. That's a message to everybody listening out here. Know what they're doing. Shrinkflation to me is very annoying. I feel like they're treating me like I'm stupid. It's like, oh, you don't have to pay anything more. We're just going to give you less. I personally would rather pay more to get what I want and then deal with prorating the amount that I'm going to eat it. But they know the average consumer can't do that and has to be controlled. So just don't let yourself be controlled in that environment. The other thing I was going to comment on, Kirk, is you were talking about sometimes there's inflation and deflation at the same time. I think a great example of deflation and inflation at the same time, although it's not directly the proper example here, is what's going on with autos, with cars, and what's going on with housing, because we are starting to see a dip in housing prices. We are starting to see a dip in auto prices. And if, without naming any companies specifically, if we see some bankruptcies occur in the auto industry here in the next 6 months to a year, if that may become, we may see a flooding of the used car market, which is going to drastically change the pricing of used cars. But here's the thing. It doesn't necessarily mean that's going to make it easy for the consumer, because while there may be a deflation of the price of the car you're going to buy because of rising interest rates, because of a lack of access to capital, I've heard stories of people with 850 credit scores going out there and trying to get a car loan from JP Morgan at 9%. So guess what? Yeah, there was a deflation on the car, but the cost of the car to the consumer has actually inflated. It is more expensive to buy the cheaper car at current financing than it was to buy a more expensive car at lesser financing. So I think going back to some of those economic obstacles that we're facing right now, the access to money, the access to capital, the cost of lending, the cost of financing is certainly one of those things that's creating an inflationary environment even on deflationary products.
One thing that's typically should happen, right? And people talk about stagflation. It's something we haven't really seen yet, although it's a little puzzling to me since there've been enormous layoffs at these large companies and they're still coming. But here's the U6 unemployment. And they highlight the recessions as periods where they're economic recessions. So right now, you could argue whether we're in a recession or not, but based on the numbers, we're not in a recession. And you could argue whether Biden's changing of the rules of what is a recession, you can make that argument one way or the other. But in some ways, they were correct because the unemployment rate is not showing a recession. And you could argue that the economy is still relatively strong. So I guess it depends on your definition, how you're defining it. Is it unemployment or is it productivity? I mean, there's a lot of ways you could define it. But I point this out because it's an important factor. When people wonder, like, oh my God, we're going to go into recession. Okay, when's that going to be? Because first people said it was going to be the beginning of this year. Then they said mid this year. And now I'm hearing the end of this year. You know, I think, frankly, you can't really see further than 6 months. I would argue that we'd probably start to see it around mid this year, but I'm not feeling it. When I mean feeling it, I mean, I've been around the block a few times. I live in the data, and it's just not feeling like we're getting there. I hate to say it, but it is possible we could have a soft landing from the Fed. Now, I don't think it's going to happen because human beings are involved and they tend to muck things up in a way that you don't predict. But to me, it feels like they're coming pretty close to making it feel like a soft landing. So if they can do that, kudos to them, because I would have given them a less than a 1% chance of that happening. But for now, they still are going to be raising rates because unemployment rate is still really, really low in comparison. Now, I also want to point out two more things here from the macro data. Is this is the U2 money supply. Now, if you look at this chart, it's not really relevant to all of those of you listening. It's not really relevant except for the trend. So this goes from 1959 up until 2022. Every single year, the money supply has increased, except for one, last year. It was down 60 basis points or 0.6% last year. The only other time that was even close was 1994, where it was only up 0.3%. Every other year, it's been 4, 6, 7, 8% in general. Now, what's that saying? Well, I'll tell you what it's saying. At the moment, it's not saying anything. But the reason I bring it up is because there is a very high correlation between increasing the money supply and the stock market. So think about it this way. If you have more money floating around, then there's more liquidity. There's more places for money to go. And technically, there's probably more inflation. Technically, but it doesn't always show up that way. And when you see this slow down or decline in this case, you could argue that that lines up with recessions or the economy and the stock market declining. Now, it's not, like I said, it's not a one-to-one correlation, but it's strong enough where you should be looking at it as an indicator. So just something to keep in mind that it could cause problems. It's not currently yet. You could look at 2020 where it was up 25%, which is double. It's double the second largest. So that in itself is saying something. So if it kept declining, I wouldn't be surprised either. The last chart I wanted to point out here is, you know, we're talking about year-end wrap-ups. So what are people seeing? There's surveys done and about 829 investors that were surveyed in this by Investopedia. So kudos Investopedia for doing this. And they surveyed, what are the reader top concerns for year-end 2022? Number one, 73%, a recession. Obviously, everybody is worried about a recession. A close second for number two is 70%. For inflation, another big concern. Rising interest rates, another big concern. And at 68% is geopolitical conflict. And then much, much further down at 41% is supply chain disruption, stagflation, labor shortage. Those are a lot lower. I think those are things people are worried about potentially in the future. Supply chain, I think fewer people understand it, but stagflation, labor shortages, Fed reducing its balance sheets, climate disasters, things like that are future potential issues. When I mean future, I mean there's really not much of a sign of stagflation. There's labor shortages, certainly, but they're not really being seen now with all the layoffs, Fed reducing its balance sheet, kind of. Climate disasters, you're looking decades out at best. So I bring this up because this is what the investor sentiment is feeling. This is what the public is feeling. It doesn't matter if it's right or wrong. I don't know if these people are right, they're wrong. Maybe we don't have a recession, so everybody here is wrong. What's important to take note of is the consumer sentiment, is how are people feeling? So if they're feeling like a recession is around the corner, then in general, you want to think about being a contrarian. It does not mean you need to be a contrarian because they could be right. It means that contrarian thinking does really well in the markets. When you have everybody on one side of the boat, it tends to tip over. So the best place to be is on the other side of the boat. So if everybody was worried about stagflation, maybe it wouldn't happen. I'm not saying it won't. But that's the way you should think about markets, is when everybody thinks like, all right, interest rates are going to keep going up. Well, you should probably fade that and interest rates will probably drop for a little bit. That's how markets work. You have to think about this as a framework going into this year. What is the one thing that's going to cause the most amount of people to lose the most amount of money? This is a question I ask myself all the time. Because more often than not, the markets will abide by that. Oh, everyone thinks the market's going to go higher. Well, maybe it's going to go sideways, or maybe it's going to go lower, or everyone thinks the market's going to crash. All right, maybe it's not going to crash. Maybe that's a sign because everyone's prepared for it. So it's probably one thing you can learn about the markets. The markets don't crash when people are prepared for it. Like they didn't crash this past year, although people would argue that it should have. Crypto crashed. But when people are not prepared for it, like 2008, 2020, those are when crashes happen because no one was prepared for 2020. Very few people were prepared for 2008. That's when crashes happen. But when people are prepared, it's more like a slow walk downhill. You're still going to lose money if you're in the markets, but it's not going to crash. There's a very big difference. So I think we have to kind of get out of the crash mentality. Everyone's worried about crashes. And I think you should be worried about what is the best place for my money, not let me go live in a cave with my guns, gold, and MREs, but how can I prepare myself for the next bear market or cycle? So what are your thoughts, Doug?
First thought is looking at the recession top concerns for recession topping reader concerns for year end 2022. My first thought is what is the 2% that are saying none of the above worried about? I mean, what, I gotta ask myself that. Like, what's their concern? Just a random thought there. The other thing I was going to say is just for fun, you were talking about everybody running to the side of the ship. Again, not to offend anybody, but here we're having fun. 2004 Amazing Facts said the other day that a boat in Texas capsized because everyone ran to one side to look at a nudist beach. So listen, you know, if everybody runs to the one side of the ship, it will indeed collapse. Other than that, Kirk, I think the things that are standing out to me on this is that we don't know what's going to go on. We talked about this before. I mean, predictions are like, you know what? There's no way to predict. If you go back to 2008, I was trying to find this chart for our conversation. And I couldn't find it. If I can, I'm going to get it to you, Kirk, to post. But at the beginning of 2008, if you look at the predictions for what was going to occur in 2008, I think there was less than 1%, maybe 5% of analysts out there predicted a negative 2008 in the market. But even the one that predicted a negative, they only predicted like a couple percent negative in the market. They kind of predicted it would just be kind of a flat year. We all know what happened. It was anything but. And that certainly made all of these really, really smart people look really, really bad. I mean, Jim Cramer was just saying right out of 2007, the worst is over, let's go. And we all know what happened in 2008, completely wrong. If you go back to inflation, we were thinking we might have a recession this year. There's been plenty of people who thought there was going to be a recession this year. There's lots of smart people who've been saying for the last 6 months that maybe, you know, third to fourth quarter of 2023 into 2024, we're going to finally hit that recession. But we don't know. Kirk, you probably remember this. They were talking about inflation. I mean, people were talking about adding inflation-adjusted bonds, TIPS, to portfolios as far back as 2013, 2012, because they looked at all of the QE that came out of 2008 and said, look, we're going to face inflation. You better get ready. Well, TIPS were a terrible investment for the last 10 years because inflation never went up. And even though people kept talking about be prepared for inflation, be prepared for inflation, a 10-year cycle where that did not occur is a generational miss. So is inflation going to be real? Well, yeah, now 2022, I think we're looking at the fact that yes, it finally happened, but it's 10 years later than people predicted. So when we start to try to give an idea of whether or not we're going to hit a recession, they've been calling for recession for probably the past 5 to 8 years, because we typically hit recessions, you know, about every 5 to 7 years we have one. We're well past that. Yes, we've had some bad years. We've had some markets. And again, if we go back to 2020, because of COVID, we kind of forced a short-term recession there. But actual economic, organically developed recession, we haven't been in anything of the such since the last crash of 2008. That's 14 years, Kirk. So it's kind of like the Yellowstone volcano. People will argue it's overdue, but I mean, it may never happen again. I think it's high probability that it will, but there's no way to predict when that's actually going to occur. And the last thing that I wanted to talk about is that M2 money supply. If you take a look at the average money supply, and a lot of, I'm just looking at that roughly, the average seems to be about, you know, anywhere from 6 to 8% is the typical percent change year to year. And there are some outliers. 1971 and 72 and 75, 76 and 77, you know, 13%, 10%. And then we saw early 1980s, we saw a couple 10, 9, 10s, 11s. And then it just kind of went back steady to kind of 5, 6% for a while. Then we got to 2020. 25% M2 money supply issued in 1 year. 2021, they followed up with 12% M2 money supply. So 37% change in M2 money supply over that 2 year period. I'll quantify that. That 25% in 2020 in 1 year alone was more than the previous 4 years took and created money supply into the environment. And that 37% over 2 years was more than what they had generated in money supply in 7 years. So it shouldn't be a shock to anybody that this time around we have inflation. We've said this before. If we go back to 2008, there was tremendous amount of money supply that was generated after the recession. In 2008, they generated 10% of QE. As much as QE produced in money supply, it was only 10%. But they followed it up with 4% and 4% in 2009, 2010, before generating a 10% and 8% change in 2011, 2012. Doesn't even come close to 1 year of 2020 and 2021. But again, M2 money supply, the government, the Fed raising all this money does not in itself equate to inflation. Because in a typical economy, if we create more money supply, the money supply that's created gets reabsorbed. If we can take that money supply and invest it in the creation of things, whether through manufacturing, through technology, or whatever we want to buy, if the consumer can take that money and then use that money to buy things and we produce more from it, there's no inflation. It's simple supply and demand. The demand goes up because people have more money, but the supply went up to meet it. What happened in 2020 and 2021 is we had not only a 37% spike in money supply, but we had an epidemic, just a catastrophic meltdown in our supply chain, right, Kirk?
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, COVID shut down. China shut down, shipping shut down, trains shut down, pork plants shut down. All of a sudden, all that money that went out there got pocketed. Doesn't mean people didn't want to spend it. They just couldn't spend it. There was nothing to spend it on. And if you take $1 and if you go from $5 of money in your pocket and $5 of goods, okay, that's $1. If all of a sudden you go to $10 in your pockets and you maintain the same amount of goods, $5 of goods, that's $2. You have just created inflation. But when you go from $5 to $20 and then you shrink the $5 of goods to one, you just took your price from $1 to $20 an item. And that's exactly what we're facing here. We are still just getting China, arguably, whether or not they do or not, is finally saying they're going to reopen on COVID. Although I heard there's a new strain that's hitting down somewhere in Southeast called the Kraken strain. So God knows what's going to happen. But ultimately, you know, if China finally reopens, we're finally going to have some level of equilibrium between the money supply that was created and the ability to buy those goods. But it's going to take a tremendous amount of time to reabsorb that money into the system. And until that money gets reabsorbed, inflation's here to stay.
That's ironic. The Kraken strain. Release the Kraken. I do want to end it up with one chart, and then we'll kind of wrap up here till next week. And hopefully we'll have a year-end numbers by then, and we can just kind of run through the global performance of all assets. This is the Buffett indicator. It's one that I like from a macro standpoint. I look at a number of big picture macro indicators. This is one I really like. So I'm going to point this out, and I've done this in the past, but I'm going to do it again here. Now, the thing to know about this is obviously things have changed in the last 70 years or so. This starts in a little bit after the 1950. So looking at this, generally speaking, you can argue that from 80 to 100 is properly valued. Anywhere from under 80 is undervalued. Anywhere from over 100, 100 to 120 is overvalued. And then anything above 120 is just ridiculous. It's ludicrous speed, as they would say in Spaceballs. Now, if you look at the early 2000s, it got up to 159. It is 149 right now. It did get up to 211, 2 years ago. So if that gives you some perspective on valuations, we're at 1999, early 2000 levels of valuation. That does not give me a warm and fuzzy feeling about the stock market continuing to go higher. And this is the Warren Buffett indicator. The old guy has been wrong before, but I think on a big picture perspective, he's a pretty sharp cookie. Sure, he's subject to making mistakes in individual stocks, but I think on a big macro level, he definitely has his stuff together. So if you look at this trend, and the Buffett indicator is very simple, it's just corporate equities to GDP ratio. You can look this up online. It's very easy to find. Just indicate the Warren Buffett indicator. You can see the chart. I will put it in the show notes, as well as you can see it if you're watching it live. So just something to keep your eye on. I'm looking to get into the markets when we're going to be 80% or below. That to me would be a phenomenal way to jump in. I don't know if we'll get there. I hope we do. And I hope not at the same time, because the destruction that's going to happen to get there is going to be tremendous. But I think we're overdue. I think we're way overvalued. Interest rates are higher and people are not respecting the fact that we're going to have higher interest rates for a longer period of time. So I think it's a good marker for valuation. People always ask, well, what's it valued at? Is it worth it? Well, I would argue very little is worth it at these valuations. I mean, there are great companies. You know, some of the tech stocks have sold off so much that they've actually become reasonable values right now. Although one in particular, which I don't particularly like philosophically, but they've come down a lot and they've actually hit a reasonable valuation marker. Now, I think they've got a long road ahead of them to get back into where they were before, but they've technically hit the valuation markers because they've sold off so much. So just something to keep in mind, because if the markets go down another 30%, they're going to go down with it, which is frankly why I'm not even taking a nibble at that stock. So just keep in mind that valuations matter. And if you have not done any fundamental analysis before, or it's been a little while since you've done it because you haven't had to do it because the markets have been a whole lot of crazy and you didn't need to do your homework for the last 14 years, it's a good time to start thinking about learning again and knocking the dust off your fundamental analysis skill set. Because you're going to need it in the next 10 years. It's going to be extremely valuable if you know how to value a stock, if you know how to evaluate a stock in terms of its financials. Learn that skill. You will need it. And if you can, you can do it well, you're going to make a boatload of money, because most people don't understand it. And it's going to be years before people even think about doing that. So Doug, we're going to wrap it up here. So final thoughts from you, and where can people find more about you?
The way you were talking about tech valuations, I was almost thinking for a moment that Cathie Wood might send you a marriage proposal, but then you pulled back just in the nick of time. Listen, to find more about me, we're talking about pricing, we're talking about inflation, we're talking about recession, we're talking about the impact of a lot of things. There's two places that I think you can get some information that's on the back of a lot of people's minds. Number one is college. College pricing has gone up astronomically more than anything else over the last couple of decades. Most people are concerned about the price of college. More than even the price, they're concerned about making sure that their children come out of that college to an extraordinary future. And they go to the right college and it ends up rocketing them into a career, walking across stage with that degree on Friday into a career on Monday. And if that's what you want for your family, if you want to make sure you're paying the right price, that you're going to get the best discounts, you're going to end up in an ideal college, look up and learn more about how to do it right, because most people overpay. And only about 97% of people that go to college end up slightly disappointed in the results of what they've paid for. We have something we call the 3% Club, and that is a special group of individuals that found the right college for the right reason, right price, academically, financially, and socially, and it ended up helping them have up to 5 times better engagement in college and their career beyond. Learn more about it. Come talk to us. ProCollegePlanners.com is our website, ProCollegePlanners.com. Find out more how you could save a college and end up at the right one.
Great. Well, Doug, I always appreciate you coming on the show. And it is one area that inflation is has forgotten about, because it has been one of the highest inflation areas of our economy for the last 20 years. So even though inflation's been 2% or below, college inflation has been ridiculous. And I don't see that going away. So I think your services are going to be invaluable in the next few years as inflation rocks everybody. But that's the show for this week. Thank you again for joining us, Money Tree Investing Podcast. My name is Kirk Chisholm, Wealth manager of Innovative Advisor Group. We don't just manage your wealth, we make your life better. You can find more about me at innovativewealth.com. And of course, you can find me every week here on the show. Please subscribe to the podcast and the podcast app of your choosing. You can also check out our show at moneytreepodcast.com. On our website, you'll have access to the show notes, resources, and the archive shows. Also, we're now on YouTube, so please check out our YouTube channel. When you're there, please subscribe and leave a comment. Lastly, please leave a show rating and comment in the podcast app of your choice. Oh, and don't forget, do your own research. This show is for informational use only. We're not telling you what to think, merely how to think about investing. We're also not selling you any products or services, and do not consider this advice. If you're having any problems with the show, I blame Putin, so please call him directly and express your feelings. If you're seeking financial advice, talk to an oracle, fortune teller, or maybe a licensed financial advisor. I'm one, but once again, I'm not selling anything. But I'm easy to find. Have a great week ahead, and remember, no one will care about your money like you do. So invest in your life.
Thank you for listening to the Money Tree Investing Podcast. Visit us at moneytreepodcast.com for more free investing resources.